evening. This is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me here on Countercurrents Radio. A little bit about myself, a little bit of background. I've been involved in, I don't know what you probably want to call it, maybe the alternative internet radio, dissent radio, white nationalist radio, whichever of those terms you prefer. That's what I've been involved in for about the last 10 years. I started off and was with Stormfront Radio for about 8 years with my Midnight Man show. Stormfront Radio began to fold and wind down. 2 years ago, I got involved with Voice of Reason Radio, which is very well produced, had some real star broadcasters, including Dr. Tom Sunich, Mark Weber of the Institute for Historical Review, Jamie Kelso, and a number of others. I was also on for a short spell with a new internet radio called Guilt Free Radio, and that was out of Southern California, out of San Diego. Unfortunately, the producer ran into some very bad health, and while we certainly still wish her well, Guilt Free Radio seems to be suspended. Well, that kind of brings us to our current venue, and that's Countercurrents. And what's happening here is that through the auspices of Countercurrents, a number of the hosts or broadcasters from the old Voice of Reason, plus a few new ones as well, are putting together a new network. It's going to have some additional technological innovations that should make our podcasts more accessible, more convenient, and so on. So we're at the beginning of a kind of an exciting future, I think. And I'd like to just introduce myself a little bit more on a personal basis. You may know who I am, in which case introduction probably not necessary. But if you don't, I'm a long-time white nationalist political activist in Canada, and I have two major issues. I'd like to say my two issues are immigration and free speech. Too much immigration and not enough free speech. So that's the way I introduce myself. I think you'll find my show deals with those issues, but also with other current political issues. And my focus is on on our people. And I'm not going to be coy about it. That's the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, and, of course, the European heartland. Our people, our tribe, is very much under attack today. Under attack internally from forces I'll be talking about from time to time, and under attack externally, because we are, in all of the European countries, we are under a persistent immigration invasion attack mostly from the Third World. Now, this is not so much an attack quarterback, as you might imagine, in the Third World, but actually quarterbacked by treasonous, some might even say treacherous, elements in our own society. So that's, in a sense, where I'm coming from. I saved you a trip to Wikipedia. Probably a waste of your time. If you went to Wikipedia, you would pick up a few truths and a whole bunch of lies. So may as well get it right from the horse's mouth. Excuse me. Hardly know where to start, but we've got to start somewhere. One of those little anomalies that we run into from time to time. Here it is. Anti-foreigner sentiment on the rise in Singapore, says my national newspaper, The Globe and Mail, on August 28th. Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong on Sunday expressed worry that rising anti-foreigner sentiment has hurt the city-state's global reputation, and he urged citizens to be more tolerant of foreigners. Quote, I think it's fair enough to express concern or to disagree with our immigration trends or to oppose our immigration policies, Mr. Lee said in his annual National Day rally speech, acknowledging that the influx of foreigners in recent years has exacerbated socioeconomic problems in the tiny Southeast Asian island. Boy, it sounds a lot like Canada and the United States, but with one exception. The Prime Minister says it's fair enough to express concern or disagree with our immigration trends or oppose our immigration policies. Well, you don't very often hear that in Canada. If you oppose, that is from a patriotic point of view, that basically there ought to be far fewer, indeed no immigration whatsoever, while we have official unemployment 7.3%. If you say that, you are, to be very nice about it, out of step. To be more direct about it, you're probably a racist or some other reprehensible sort of person. Well, the article actually gets better. Prime Minister of Singapore goes on to say, but I'm worried by some of the nasty views that are expressed, especially online and especially anonymously, Mr. Lee said. Such outbursts by citizens against foreigners on the internet and in public, quote, reflect badly on us and damage our international reputation. People think that Singapore is anti-foreigner and xenophobic. Well, what if it is? Nobody, no people like to be invaded. And the article continues. The Prime Minister's comments came after Singapore's government in July announced a new measure to control the inflow of foreigners. Policymakers are trying to strike a balance in keeping the city-state a top destination for foreign workers and new immigrants, seen as a way to offset Singapore's low birth rate while containing anti-foreigner settlements. So it's all a con job and a balancing act. Resentment against foreigners isn't new in Singapore, the article continues, where large numbers of wealthy expatriates live. In 2011, nearly 40% of Singapore's population of 5.2 million were foreign-born permanent residents or temporary residents, government data show. Singapore citizens had made up 74% of the population in 2000 and 91% in 1980. Some of the complaints of native Singaporeans are that the foreign-born residents take jobs, push up property prices, and add new strains on the city-state's infrastructure, especially its crowded or overcrowded subways. The article continues. Criticism of foreigners has taken on increasingly xenophobic tone over the past year, analysts say, with more Singaporeans returning to social media to broadcast their views. Tensions also heightened amid recent incidents, including a deadly car crash in May caused by a Chinese national. Is that surprising? A Chinese national in a speeding Ferrari and an assault on a local driver by three expatriates, racial background not mentioned, in 2010. New arrivals must embrace our values, commit themselves to Singapore, and integrate into our community, says the Prime Minister. And finally, Singapore's parliament is also mulling changes to toughen its immigration law, the first changes, major changes since 2004. If passed, it would make marriages of convenience entered into to obtain immigration privileges a criminal offense, among other steps. Wow. Not much different from North America. We just had a big scandal here in Canada where arranged marriages, a person that was coordinating the arranging of marriages, mostly with white French Canadian women and Muslim immigrants from the would-be immigrants from the Arab world, this was broken up. So marriages of convenience, disrespect for the local traditions by large numbers of foreigners, and the understandable resentment of people having their country radically changed, often, as in Canada, without the say-so or without the consultation, I mean meaningful consultation, of the host population. You know, these are real issues, and one of the things that interests me in this particularly is that nothing has changed, has it? This is exactly what the way people in Europe, the way people in Canada and the United States, when we're ever allowed to express an opinion, that's exactly the way people feel. So, this accusation, it's one of those $10 Greek words that's supposed to make you shiver with shame if it's applied to you. And that's that word, xenophobia. There's nothing unusual about so-called xenophobia. Everybody feels it. Nobody wants their country taken over. Nobody wants their country radically changed. It's not a racial thing or something that only we in North America do. No people in the world. And incidentally, if the racial makeup of Singapore isn't immediately at your fingertips, it's something like this. The vast majority in Singapore are Chinese. Small minority of Malays, small minority of East Indians, and a small minority of white people. So it's basically a Chinese area, but they like any other healthy people, simply don't want to have their country radically changed or taken over. I have a very uneasy feeling about this guy. There's a Jewish mega daddy Warbucks, a billionaire named Sheldon Adelson. And he's a casino magnate headquartered in Las Vegas. He pumped a couple of $1 million into the failed campaign of Newt Gingrich, allowing Newt to win, I believe, South Carolina with a massive publicity blitz in the last week or so. Not very long after that, Newt was asked, "Well, what would you do if you became president and you received a phone call and were told that on the line was President Netanyahu and he was calling you as a courtesy to let you know, as president, that Israel had just attacked Iran?" And Newt's response was, "Is there any way we can help?" So Adelson is a rabid Zionist. His money bought a very outspoken, dutiful poodle. Now, of course, time went on. Newt Gingrich did not make it to the convention. I think he got one vote. But now Adelson has switched his shekels to Mitt Romney. I've seen pictures of this Adelson. He looks like a dwarfish troll. Now, I don't mean to make a judgment solely on a person's appearance, but he's a most unwholesome-looking person. he so far contributed at least $35 million to Republican groups and candidates. This past Tuesday, no, I'm sorry, two Tuesdays ago, Paul Ryan, who, of course, is Mitt Romney's vice presidential nominee, appeared at a fundraiser at the Sands Venetian Casino in Las Vegas, and Adelson was supposed to attend. Well, Adelson is now in problems in China. Over some of his connections. When Sheldon Adelson needed something done in China, he often turned to his company's chief Peking representative, a mysterious businessman named Yang Saxin. Mr. Yang arranged meetings for Mr. Adelson with senior Chinese government officials and acted as a front man on several ambitious projects for Mr. Adelson's company, which is the Las Vegas Sands Corporation. Adelson has extensive interest in one of the gambling hotspots of the Orient, namely the former Portuguese colony of Macau. Mr. Yang, however, along with tens of millions of dollars in payments from the Sands made through him to China, is a focus of a wide-ranging federal investigation into potential bribery of foreign officials and other matters in China and Macau, according to people in the know. So at the present time, Mr. Adelson is also the subject of an investigations by the FBI, the State Department, and the Security and Exchange Commissions. One of those uncomfortable characters in the background, and you wonder what influence will he have on Mitt Romney. I mention that because a couple weeks ago, Mitt Romney set off during the Summer Olympics for a brief foreign tour. He went to
England and became victim of foot and mouth disease, putting his own foot in his mouth, making some rather unflattering comments about the preparedness of the British capital for the Olympics. Then he went on to Israel, and that's where I really had a problem with his foreign tour. There he was announcing that he would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. This is extremely provocative. Normally the capital is considered to be Tel Aviv. Three religions claim Jerusalem as a sacred city. Christians, of course, Muslims, and Jews. This is, of course, the claiming Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel is a long time demand of the radical Zionists. It's something that other groups equally strongly resist and object to. Romney, of course, paid the mandatory, it would appear, visit to the wall and bowed his head and did God knows what all else in the presence of a number of advisors and rabbis. His nearest advisor for this trip is also a rabid Zionist, actually studied in Canada. And you have to ask yourself, at what price all of this? Is Mitt Romney going to represent the United States, be president of the United States, or will he simply be a messenger boy for Israel? I could understand a campaign trip to Los Angeles, San Francisco, a farm in Iowa, a mine in West Virginia, of course. But why would a candidate, well, this, at this point, virtually a guaranteed candidate for his party, why would he visit Israel? It's a state of a little over 6 million people. I could understand if he was trying to brush up his foreign policy credentials to visit China, Mexico, India, Russia. Why Israel? Well, I'm not being coy. The reason is simple. The unwholesome power of the Israeli lobby is a thing that creates fear in many, many American politicians. And it's a very real power. The AIPAC, that's the America-Israel Political Action Committee, can direct tens of millions of dollars to people who toe the pro-Israel, the Zionist party line, and equally pour money into the coffers of opponents of people, the odd person, who bucks the party line. And a potential free thinker might find himself challenged at a primary and defeated, or if he makes it through the primary, challenged at the general election by an incredibly well-funded opponent. As far back as the 1970s, a long-standing powerhouse in the United States Senate, the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee, J. William Fulbright, suddenly found himself knocked off after, I think it was something like 30-some years in the Senate. You know, usually the incumbency is an incredibly powerful advantage. And there, in the days when Arkansas was part of the deep, almost solidly Democratic South, along came an extremely well-funded challenger, and Fulbright was defeated. Reason? Fulbright was less than enthusiastic in his support of Israel and had questions about America's backing of Israel as a cornerstone of Middle East policy. So I understand to some extent why Mitt Romney went to Israel and put on a beanie, put on, you know, that always bothers me. Why does a politician with some ethnic groups feel he has to dress up and act like a clown? You know, Romney's not a Jew. He's a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, more usually referred to as Mormons. Why would he dress up like this? I think it's degrading and demeaning. I think an honorable politician should be able to go and say, this is who I am. I'm not of your faith. I'm here on a visit. I'm prepared to express my views against you and listen to yours. But I'm not going to do obeisance. I'm not going to kneel down to you. And that's what this dress, Mr. Dress-up thing, is, as far as I'm concerned. I think if a politician were to go to the Vatican, who's not a Catholic, it would be degrading on both sides if he were to put on a big, foot-long crucifix hanging around his neck. I mean, that's not who he is. Why should he have to pretend to be something that he isn't? And what bothers me about the symbolism is, it is not saying, I'm representing my people here. It's rather, I'm going to try to adopt your agenda and implement it back home, your agenda among my people. I think that's incredibly unhealthy. Equally of concern are some of the advisors that Mitt Romney has assembled for his foreign policy, and I'll mention just one, but there's a long list of them, and one is Michael Chertoff. Now, he's the former head of Homeland Security. He is the son of a New Jersey rabbi. He is a dual citizen. Dual citizen of what? The United States and Mexico? No. United States and Canada? No. United States and Israel? Fair question. Where does his loyalty lie? Now, I think that's a fair question, because there is a huge potential conflict of loyalty. Israel is hell-bent on war with Iran. There's been a war that they hope America will largely wage. So it'll be American men and regrettably some women who will be on the firing line and will die in another war for Israel. Now, the issue is Iran's nuclear program. Israel, and depends on who you listen to in the United States, the CIA denies that this is true, but some people say Iran is trying to build its nuclear program to the point of acquiring or having enough enriched uranium that it can build the atomic bomb. Some say that's the case, some deny that's the case. Many governments, including that of the United States and certainly Israel, have said that is unacceptable. Iran cannot be allowed to have nuclear weapons. Now, are they acquiring them? As I say, there's two schools of thought and two contradictory bodies of information. However, there have been assassinations of a number of Iranian scientists involved in the nuclear program, almost certainly carried out by Mossad, that's the Israeli Secret Service, and or with the cooperation of the United States. There's been high-tech computer viruses introduced into computers in Iran, one of which made the centrifugal equipment in one of the big Iranian nuclear facilities go crazy. So they basically burned out and destroyed the machines. Definitely, there are powerful forces in Israel that want an attack on Iran. It's vital for a potential president like Mr. Romney to be very clear as to where he stands. Well, where he stands is 110%, yeah, you guessed it, for Israel. But Israel's interests are not necessarily, in fact, I would say, are not necessarily those of the United States. I would say they're diametrically opposed to those of the United States. Do you want a war with Iran? Do you want an attack on Iran? Well, if you do, then I guess your interests are similar to Israel's. But if you don't, if you think that is immoral, and that's wrong, and it's going to be a problem. And Iran is a much bigger country, a much
more defender-friendly country than Iraq was. Much of Iraq is really flat territory. Iran is mountainous. Any war with Iraq and with Iran is going to be bloody, it's going to be costly, and it's going to send a lot of Americans back in body bags. Now, I think one has to ask oneself, well, then, why would one want to go to war? And one also wants to know, what's the stand of a major political figure like Mitt Romney, who was at that point going to get the Republican nomination, now, of course, has the Republican nomination. Where does he stand? Well, it seems he stands with Israel. But that cannot be acceptable as American foreign policy. I might point out the Canadian government also stands with Israel. Our prime minister says an attack on Israel is an attack on Canada. We don't even say that about the United States. So we have 110% Israel firster in Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper. But is it really in our interest, our being Canada or the United States, to back Israel? Well, let's start looking at some of the assumptions. One assumption is Iran must not be allowed to acquire nuclear weapons. And I point out, it's still not at all certain that they are acquiring nuclear weapons, but let's assume they are. Why would it not be acceptable? Well, I agree. It's not desirable. Nuclear weapons are a terrible thing. And yes, in an ideal Mary Poppins world, there wouldn't be any. But we don't live in such a world. So, okay, back to the main question. Why shouldn't Iran acquire nuclear weapons? Look at it from Iran's point of view. It's in an area of the world where it faces many hostile or questionable neighbors, many of whom have nuclear weapons. To the east, you have India and Pakistan. Neither of them necessarily a friend of Iran. To the north and east, you have China. To the north, you have Russia, all of which have nuclear weapons. To the west, you have Iraq. Well, technically speaking, Iraq doesn't have nuclear weapons, but its big backer, the United States, does. And then farther west, its mortal enemy, Israel, the Zionist-occupied state of Israel. And they have nuclear weapons. Now, how in a fair universe can you say, oh, but Iran, you can't have nuclear weapons? You know, part of good diplomacy is winning the battle for public opinion. And to impose striking unfairness on people isn't going to win many friends. Now, there are people who say, well, the rulers of Iran are religious crazies. Well, that's a judgment call. No doubt the rulers of Iran are very strong Shiite Muslim views. Very strong views. Does that make them crazy? Well, I don't know. But I don't think they're impractical crazy. And I'll tell you how the nuclear problem can be solved very easily. You tell Iran two things. Number one, we prefer that you not develop nuclear weapons. But, you know, if you feel it's in your interest as an independent sovereign country to do so, we'll accept that. But secondly, understand this. Any attack by your weapons on North America or Europe will be met with the mother of all counterattacks and will lead to the devastation of your country. Now, that would be, in my opinion, an America and a Canada and a Europe first policy. Number one, we grant you the same respect that we want for ourselves. France and England are nuclear powers. The United States is a nuclear power. I think it's really unfair and unacceptable to say we can have these weapons, but you cannot. I mean, that doesn't fly. I think it's perfectly acceptable to say, but don't you dare attack us. Because if you do, we've got more than you do, and we're going to hurt you, and we're going to hurt you badly. I mean, that's perfect. That is a perfect a response among mature people. Granting them the respect and the right, if they choose to do it, to develop nuclear weapons, but also pointing out to them that we would take a very dim view, and this is exactly what will happen to you if you attack us. Notice what I did not say. If they attack Israel. Because I don't think we should be protecting Israel. Israel is a thorn in the side of the Middle East. And it is an endless provocation. Now, not all the problems in the Middle East are the fault of the Israelis. Poverty is a big problem. Poisonous conflicts, and you know, all people think of conflict in the Middle East is Arabs and Jews, or more specifically, Muslims and Jews. That's one of the conflicts, but it's by no means the only one. I visited the Middle East 10 years ago, and I was there just long enough to know that it's a snake pit of conflicts and hatreds. And when you think of the Middle East, think about a piece of shattered glass, not broken glass, but shattered. You know, if a stone hits a windshield, it doesn't normally poke a hole through it, but what happens is that the glass shatters in sort of a cobweb pattern. That's what the Middle East looks like. It's not just Jews and Arabs. It's not just Sunni Muslims versus Shiite Muslims. It's not just non-Muslims versus non-Arabs versus Arabs. For instance, there's a huge conflict between Iran and the Arab Gulf states, because the Iranians are not Arabs. They actually, if you look at the word Iranian, it comes from Aryan, and they were one of the areas settled by the Aryan or Indo-European people about 3,000 or more years ago. There have been population invasions. Many Iranians would still be classified as Indo-European or white. The language of Farsi is an Indo-European or Aryan language. So those are just a few of the conflicts. And there's the conflicts between more fundamentalist Muslims and their backsliding brethren, fundamentalist Muslims like the Arab Brotherhood. There are tribal animosities. Then, of course, there's the problem, the conflict between, in some areas, between Christians and Muslims. Although often Christians get along with the Muslims. There's, of course, the conflict between rich and poor, and so on. So the Middle East is not a simple place to understand. It also means that any America first policy, those what I'm pointing out, a policy that puts the interests of our country, whether our country is the United States or Canada first, cannot just simplistically say our side in the Middle East is the Israelis. Well, that's what we've said. And the results have been a number of wars for Israel. The two Iraq wars, for as examples, Afghanistan, and now the one on the horizon, coming war, or at least the desire on some part by some parties for war against Iran. Now, what's in our interests? That's important, not Israel's interests. What's in our interests? Well, what's in our interests is, first of all, peace. A region in flames is probably no country's interest. I like to think of the model of mature relationships. Trade with all, aid to none. We want to trade with you. We want to sell you our goods. We want to buy your goods, primarily oil. That's what we want. We don't want to get involved in regional conflicts because, as I would like to think I've suggested, it's very hard to... not only is it very hard to know who is right, there are many, many, many agendas in the Middle East. And to simplistically choose one side, we're backing Israel, means that we are needlessly alienating a whole lot of other people. I just don't think it's good strategy. And never mind what I say or think. In his farewell address, the first American president, George Washington, warned against entangling alliances. Now, once you line up with these people, as opposed to those people, you get entangled. And that's exactly what Israel has been trying to do to the United States. Israel essentially wants the United States to be its big brother, or I should say its enforcer. And that means committing American soldiers, putting them into dangerous and situations, putting their lives at risk for the benefit of another country. Highly dangerous, wrong, and not in the best interests of the United States. The United States and Canada should have a policy of putting their interests first, not the interests of a foreign power. And that's why the Israeli lobby is so subversive of healthy nationalism. It essentially buys up American politicians. And there isn't a nice way to put it. It isn't a matter of winning on the basis of better arguments or information. Essentially, if you don't go along with pro-Israeli policies, they will and can hurt you. They can give political donations to their friends and give donations to the friends of their enemies. I'm sorry, I got that wrong. The enemies of their enemies. So if you buck them, they can support your challenger in the primary, and they can support your opponent in the general election. Not only that, but the very extensive Zionist power in the mass media is probably as powerful as the financial cudgel they hold over the American political system. Because the possibility of having good publicity if you play ball, or bad publicity if you don't. For many politicians, this is absolutely terrifying. And so they knuckle under. Well, what can be done? Well, I think one thing is the consistent exposure of the Zionist lobby. Letting your fellow citizens know their tremendous power, and let them know as well the damage that this is doing. That you essentially have bought up politicians. And that's not good for America. And if that discussion gets out there more, then there will be perhaps some brave politicians who will say, we will not take their money, and these are the principles on which I stand, and these principles are what are putting what's good for America first. Politicians are by nature cowards. Now, I say that really as an observation, not as not by way of making a nasty moral comment, but they are. They're cowardly. They don't want to take huge chances. They really want to win. That's all they want. They want to win the election. As long as we have an ignorant or deluded electorate, then the coward in the politician says, I can't afford to be smeared. Even if I know what I'm doing is contrary to the interests of my country, if I buck the Israeli lobby, I will be smeared in the media. They will call me nasty names, among them probably being anti-Semite, and a stupid electorate will go, bah, bah, that's the wolf, bah, and vote for my opponent. I can't afford that. It's not pretty. It's not nice. And it doesn't talk. It doesn't show us a world of highly moral people. That's the political cesspool, as my friend, that fellow broadcaster James Edwards says. That's the reality of politics in the United States today. It's a political cesspool. So, okay, what can we do? Well, what we can do, first of all, is to inform a lot of our fellow citizens in Canada, the United States, of what the reality is. Don't get taken in by this. Demand that the politicians put your interests first. You know, that makes them really uncomfortable. Because they'd like to create the notion that being pro-Israel is important to the United States. In fact, it's highly detrimental to the United States. About a week ago, I picked up another paper called the National Post. It's another, it's a neocon paper in Canada. Often contains some good articles. And lo and behold, what do I see? The difference between genocide and invective. Oh, okay. Sounds interesting. Well, what's all that about? Well, it starts off blaming the Europeans for not being critical enough of some recent statements coming out of Iran. Iran or Israel? Which is more deserving of censure? On the one hand, as the French news agency Agence France-Presse reported last week, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is calling Israel, quote, a cancerous tumor that he threatened will soon be excised. He added, the nations of the region will soon finish off the usurper Zionists. With the grace of God and the help of the nations in the new Middle East, there will be no trace of Zionists. Okay, on the other hand, the Agence France-Presse article goes on to say, Israel has been employing its own invective against Iran and its leaders, invoking the image of Hitler and the Nazis on the eve of the Second World War and accusing Tehran of plotting on Israeli genocide. So, to make a somewhat long, long story a little shorter, the author of this piece, Clifford D. May, he's president of the Foundations for Defense of Democracies, says that there is no equivalence. Israeli invective and saber-rattling is not the same as or nearly as bad as Iranian invective, and it's those leftist Europeans that simply don't know the difference, want to be too fair, and should be vigorously criticizing Iran and not criticizing Israel. The article says to acknowledge that Iran's rulers are akin to Nazis and are threatening genocide carries disagreeable policy implications. Among other things, it suggests that Iran's rulers should at all costs be prevented from acquiring nuclear weapons. But anyone who says that's Europe, risks being labeled a warmonger or a neoconservative. There is this another possibility too, says this article. The Agence France-Presse article expresses anti-Israelism and perhaps also the most ancient and durable of biases. Don't get me wrong, not everyone who criticizes Israel is a Jew hater. Not everyone who hates Israel, but all Jew haters do criticize and hate Israel. Well, that's the opinion of the columnist there, and then he really gets down to the core of what he wants. The well-known international human rights lawyer Erwin Kotler, a former Canadian Minister of Justice and Attorney General, has been making a strenuous effort to remind Western leaders that there is a genocide convention that they have an obligation, legal, moral, and strategic, to enforce. Quote, the Iranian regime's criminal incitement has been persistent, pervasive, and pernicious, says Kotler. The incident is also former president of the Canadian Jewish Congress. We're not told that, though, are we? In particular, this genocidal incitement has intensified and escalated in 2012, with the website of Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, that's the Supreme Leader of Iran, declaring that there is religious justification to kill all the Jews and annihilate Israel, and Iran must take the helm. Well, you've got to be careful of translations. Ahmadinejad has been the target of the Zionist lobby for a fair number of years, but particularly since 2006, when his ministry hosted a Holocaust colloquium in Tehran, one where people who did not agree with the Hollywood version of World War II or the standard account of the Holocaust were invited and permitted to speak, along with, and this must be remembered, a fair number of people who supported what you might call the Hollywood version of World War II or the traditional account of the Holocaust. But the very fact that he allowed a debate has been hugely held against him. And so a comment he made has been repeated over and over. The translation is just not accurate, and the context is wrong. Yes, in the rather overblown rhetoric of much of the Middle East, Ahmadinejad did call Israel a cancer that had to be excised, and that he predicted that the usurper Zionists would soon be finished. Now, let's look at that. Is that a call for genocide? Well, let's look at Iran. Iran, believe it or not, has a Jewish population. Small, true. I believe it's in the neighborhood of about 20,000. They even have a representative in the Majlis, or the Iranian parliament. They have been repeatedly urged by Israel and others to leave. Leave Iran. They have said no, they don't want to. Iran is their home. Now, surely, if genocide was Ahmadinejad's purpose, why wait to get to Israel, exterminate the Jews that live in his own country? He hasn't. And the reaction of the Iranian Jews showed a fair degree of security, of comfort, where they are. Sure, they're a minority. Iran is a religious state, a Shiite Muslim religious state, even as Israel is a religious state, but a Jewish religious state. Nonetheless, Iran's Jews feel sufficiently comfortable to not want to join a flight to Israel. What Ahmadinejad is saying is that the Zionist government, as opposed to Jews, but the Zionist government, that is a Jewish religious state plunked down in the land that belonged to others. And that's often very much overlooked. There were very, very few Jews in the province of Palestine that was then, at the beginning of the 20th century, a part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. The population was roughly 50-50 Christians of various sorts and Muslims. There began, after 1897, an organized influx of mostly European Jews to set up a homeland for Jews in what they said was their traditional stomping grounds in Palestine. And that would become, and that eventually did become, in 1848, the State of Israel. Now, they were augmented by repeated waves of European Jews who came to join them. Eventually, the indigenous Palestinians, Christian and Muslim, were displaced. In some cases, their orchards, their homes were seized, were stolen. Many of them ended up for decades in squalid refugee camps. And when they tried to fight that, well, of course, many in the world call them terrorists. I don't mean to be a moral relativist, but one man's terrorist is the next man's freedom fighter. What do you make of people who came from Europe assassinating Muslims or Palestinians in Palestine, which is what terror groups like the Irgun did Prime Minister Menachem Begin was a prominent member of the Irgun. The Irgun assassinated a Swedish diplomat who was there to work out peace, Folke Bernadotte. They blew up the King David Hotel containing many British Army officers. They assassinated members of the British Palestine Police. Now, what would you call that? Well, I'd call it terrorism. When radical pro-Palestinian folks attacked the Jewish team at the Munich Olympics in 1972, virtually nobody had problems calling that terrorism, and yes, it was. But you have to, I think, put that in a context. Now, put that all together, and what do you have? What you have is Ahmadinejad, in fact, saying Zionism's a terrible thing. It is the Zionist state of Israel is a cancer in the Middle East, and he predicts it will soon be expunged and gone. That's not the same thing as calling for genocide. He didn't say he wanted every Jew wiped out. He didn't say, because he could do that in his own country, and he hasn't. Now, this is what I mean by applying some thought. Now, the Zionist lobby, and in this case led by Erwin Kotler, I have to remember, former president of the Canadian Jewish Congress. Mr. Kotler appointed many of his co-religionists to the Supreme Court of Canada. He was a strong backer of Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act when it was changed in 2001 to as a response to the 9/11 attacks. That extended the control of the unelected Canadian Human Rights Commission, where truth is no defense, intent is no defense, to the internet. And over 50 people have been dragged before human rights tribunals. Their rights horribly abused, and this law has actually now finally been repealed. But that was something Mr. Kotler was for. But his name is always tied to the term human rights. Human rights, what does that mean? And if human rights includes freedom of speech, Kotler's not a human rights lawyer. Anyway, he's all for implementing the Genocide Convention. So he would like the governments of the world, and Canada's too, to charge, the government of Iran under the Genocide Convention. So he claims we have a legal, moral, and obligation to do so. Kotler points out that not one state party to the Genocide Convention has undertaken any of its mandated responsibilities to prevent and punish such incitement. An appalling example of the international community as bystanders. Reminding us also that genocide occurred not only because of cultures of hate, but because of crimes of indifference. So, Kotler would like the nations of the world to charge Iran. I don't know if that means arrest Iranian diplomats and so on, with incitement to genocide. Fact is, there is no incitement to genocide. There is on the part of Iran and many other Middle Eastern countries an opposition to the state of Israel. It's not the same thing as genocide. I find the story interesting on a number of levels, but one that particularly intrigues me is that a few years ago, when finally mainstream attention in Canada focused on Section 13 of the Canadian Human Rights Act. That's the prohibited willful promotion of, exposing to hatred or contempt privileged minority groups, including Jews. Now, exposing to hatred or contempt. None of that was ever defined. In these proceedings, they didn't have to prove that anybody had actually, other than the complainant, had ever even read the passage on the internet. They didn't have to prove anybody was actually impressed or moved by it.
all that there had to be was that the words were there that were likely to expose, whatever likely meant. Hatred or contempt. Well, okay, hatred may be a fairly strong emotion, but what about contempt? Contempt is really nothing more than a negative opinion about a group. And presumably, if the audience accepted that negative opinion, then they would hold the view in the group in less esteem, and that would be exposing that group to contempt. All of these based on a lot of ifs that none of these tribunals ever investigated. For instance, you know, just because I say something to you today doesn't mean you believe me. If I present you with an argument, you may say, well, I'd love to think about that, or that doesn't seem right to me. Or you may say, yeah, I agree. But just because I say it doesn't mean I've moved you. Just because I say it doesn't mean you say, oh, really? Mr. Fromm says that it must be right. In fact, you might be entirely justified to say, I've never met this guy. Oh, I don't know whether he's right or not. That is perfectly reasonable. And that's the way I think we treat a lot of the material we see on the internet. Some we believe and agree with, some we would take the exact opposite of point of view of the words in front of us on the page. And none of that was part of these kangaroo courts, or otherwise known as human rights tribunals. No sophistication in understanding how communications in the real world actually do occur. But anyway, Mr. Cochrane is all for that type of suppression of free speech. But, oh yes, finally, the activities of the Human Rights Commissions and tribunals came to the attention of some members of the mass media. Now, not through any research they did. We've been telling them about this for years and being received with nothing more than one big ignorant cacyon. But when several journalists came under attack, at that point they began to pay attention. I remember way back at that time, somebody whose name I forget, but he was relatively prominent, said, well, the free speech forces in Canada they need a leader. They need a highly visible leader. Well, maybe they should try to recruit somebody like Irwin Coughlin. And I shook my head and thought, on all every level, this is so stupid and benighted. For one thing, the free speech movement in Canada has had leaders. It's not leaders. My friend, attorney Doug Christie, has been a leader in the free speech battle in Canada going back to 1984. I've been the head of the Canadian Association for Free Expression going back to 1981. That's 31 years. Not to be vainglorious, but the free speech movement in Canada did have leaders, does have leaders. But the thought that we would need a new leader, an Irwin Coughlin, I just shook my head at the naivety. But worse than that, the bone ignorance. Coughlin is not a fan of free speech. In fact, he's a mortal enemy of free speech. And while he was still Attorney General, he continued the persecution of Mark Lemire, the man who finally, his case, broke the nefarious activities and dirty tricks activities of the Canadian Human Rights Commission wide open. No, Cocker, no friend of free speech. I wonder if on some level there weren't people in Canada or people who held those views that said, well, the cause is only legitimate if it's led by it. Thank you. And I think that's, if that was part of the settlement, that's the most pathetic of all. Why should situation occur where a group that represents less than 1% of the Canadian population, Jews are about 310,000 in a population of a little over 34 million, so they're fewer than 1%. Why should a cause only be legitimate if you have as a spokesman a person who's Jewish? That is as wrong-headed as to say that a cause is only legitimate if you have a spokesman who's a Newfoundlander.
It's interesting to see just how war propaganda works. And part of war propaganda is to confuse the public. And to confuse in such a way as they'll make the wrong decision. Wrong decision in this case would be, well, Iran wants to exterminate the Jews. They want another Holocaust. Therefore, we should go to war against Iran to stop it. There was similar propaganda in the Second World War. Many Canadians believed, and there are still some who do, that Hitler had to be stopped because he wanted to conquer the world. This, of course, was the exact contrary to everything Adolf Hitler had ever said. His interests were a free hand in Europe. Particularly, he wanted to reunite German populations that wanted to be part of Germany, but had been separated from them by the ridiculous Versailles Treaty of 1919, which chopped up Europe, in many cases, into irrational, incoherent states, where ethnic populations were divided from one another, and so on. That was one goal. He wanted to reunite German people into one state. Germans in Austria, Germans in the Sudetenland, which is part of Czechoslovakia, a very persecuted German minority in Poland, and so on. That was one goal. Another goal was to expand his territory. He emphatically did not want to conquer the world. In fact, he saw an alliance between his regime on the continent and the British Empire. Not a fight, but an alliance. The British would keep their empire and run their empire and benefit that way. He would have a free hand on the continent. That's what he wanted. He never envisioned he was going to invade the world, conquer the world. He didn't have the forces. He didn't have the forces to invade England. So the notion that Hitler was going to conquer the world was not only ludicrous, it was the exact opposite of what he had said. But that idea was put out by persistent propaganda, so that even today some people say, that was the good war, as my friend Mark Weber says. That was the good war. We stopped Hitler from conquering the world. Well, Hitler was in no position to conquer the world, and had no intention of, quote, conquering the world. A relatively small country, Germany, which I think may have had about 90 million people. How was that going to conquer even the United States, which at that point had 150 million? To say nothing of Russia, which had probably pretty close to that, or China, and so on and so on. It just wasn't in the cards. You know, it was a scare tactic to exploit the fears of naive people or fools. But that's what wartime propaganda does. It sets up an unrealistic demon of an enemy, and then in the hopes that most people will turn off their brains and just blindly follow. Not that long ago, remember that when the United States decided to dump Saddam Hussein, this would be in the Bush's first war. Suddenly, he who had recently been a CIA ally in the fight with Iran, Saddam was now being referred to as the Hitler of the Middle East. As soon as I heard that, I knew there's going to be problems. And then when we were told by Bush the second is. In the prelude to the second Gulf War in 2003, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. He had nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons, and if Iraq was not invaded and Saddam stopped, why, if there wasn't a regime change, why, you know, heaven knows what he'd do with those weapons. Fact was, he didn't have them. In fact, one of the reasons the Americans just basically cut through Iraq like a warm knife through butter, was a highly sophisticated and highly technological armed forces, namely that of the United States, was up against an army with the Soviet technology of the 1960s. The Iraqi armed forces, even the best units, were several arms generations out of date. And they had virtually no air force. That had been shot out of the skies. There never were weapons of mass destruction. A lot of people, though, forget that. They were bamboozled into supporting a war against an enemy that didn't exist. Polls have shown that over half the American people believe that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. Now, I know 9/11 is a very, very controversial topic, so it's hard to make any statement on that that somebody isn't going to disagree with. However, let's take the conventional explanation that 9/11 was done by Al-Qaeda-trained terrorists who attacked or commandeered the planes that took down the World Trade Centers, made the attack on the Pentagon, and the fourth plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. But let's assume that account is true. But where was Saddam Hussein in all this? Well, there's no connection. Because Saddam was roundly hated by the Al-Qaeda people, who were militant Muslims. They saw him as a scotch-drinking, backsliding Muslim, one who didn't keep the faith very well. He was a secularist. He was not a religious fanatic. He had nothing to do with 9/11. And even his worst enemies wouldn't say he did. Now that I think that's pretty widely accepted about the war with Iraq, we've got to be sharp and we've got to be careful. So I urge you to read every statement that is made about the Middle East. Statements leading you to the conclusion that we ought to go to war. I urge you to read them very, very carefully, because quite often they are just propaganda. And the thing that we have to keep coming back to is what is in the interests of the United States and Canada. We must put our interests first, not the interests of a foreign state. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me, and I will be back again very, very shortly. We should have at least one broadcast a week. Do hope you can tune in. If you'd like to reach me personally, I'll give you my email. It's paul@paulfromm.com. Very simple, P-A-U-L at paulfromm.com. Hope to be back with you in the very, very near future here on Countercurrents Radio. And I'm going to sign off with a good old Irish Rebels tune, A Nation Once Again. Love, pride, the summer glow, a shine.